Welcome to the second episode of Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast. I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Cindy Franklin.
And if you listened to last week's episode, or I guess last episode, it's about 2 weeks ago, the last episode, then you know this is a geek free-for-all podcast. We talk about things we like, comics, movies, sci-fi horror, classic horror. We don't like the gory stuff. That type of thing, and we chit-chat about it, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. So last time we were talking about famous comic book couples, married couples, and we did Aquaman and Mira, and Reed and Sue Richards, Mr. Fantastic and Invisible Woman from Fantastic Four, and then Hawkman and Hawkgirl. And so this time we saved the big ones for last. We're going to do Spider-Man and Mary Jane, and Superman and Lois Lane, and that kind of rhymes, which is weird. So we're going to not bore you with any other details of anything else. We're going to cut right to it, so let's go.
All right. So first up, of course, is Spider-Man and Mary Jane. And opening line, which kind of defines the relationship. Face it, Tiger, you just hit the jackpot. Those were the first words spoken by Mary Jane Watson on her first true appearance in Amazing Spider-Man number 42 in November of 66, as an astonished Peter Parker looks and stares at the gorgeous redhead in his doorway. Mary Jane was initially a running gag in the Spider-Man title, with Peter's doting and, can I say, meddling Aunt May often reminding Peter of how she wanted him to meet MJ, who was the niece of her friend and neighbor, Anna Watson. This went as far back as Amazing Spider-Man number 15, with MJ showing up in the flesh in issue 25, so that's 10 issues. Peter's then-love interest, Liz Allen, and Betty Brant were shocked by her beauty, but readers could not see her face. It was hidden behind a scarf and convenient plant in the foreground of the panel. By the time MJ showed her face, original artist and Spidey co-creator Steve Ditko had departed, and John Romita had assumed the artist chores. While Ditko is the undisputed form, or an undisputed master of the form, few can draw women as attractive as Romita, so it's only fitting that he designed this knockout party girl.
I think if it's hard to imagine a world where Steve Ditko designed Mary Jane Watson. I mean, I think it would have changed the... it seems weird to say that, but I think it would have changed the course of Spider-Man's history. If he had designed Mary Jane, who knows what she would have looked like. And I don't think... The thing with Mary Jane, for the first 20 years of her existence, it's almost she's almost pure visual. And that Romita look stayed the same. And everybody drew her that way. And he sure knew how to draw women. And so if... And as much as I like Ditko, he's well known for drawing ugly people. I mean, he drew people that looked like people you'd bump into on the street that you see pushing a cart at Walmart or something. And who knows what Mary Jane would have looked like. I'm sure he would have made her look attractive as much as in the Ditko way. But even the most beautiful woman that Steve Ditko could draw didn't look anything like even the most bland woman John Romita could draw. So, who knows what would have happened.
Well, the reason Spider co-creator and writer Stan Lee introduced MJ was as a rival for Gwen Stacy, who Peter was also attracted to. Peter and MJ dated for a bit, but he soon found her too shallow and obsessed with partying. The more level-headed Gwen was Maury's speed, and they soon began a long and loving relationship. MJ, in the meantime, began to date Harry Osborn, Peter's college roommate, and the son of Norman Osborn, also known as the Green Goblin, Spidey's most dangerous foe. MJ was never one to stay tied down, and she eventually dumped Harry, who could not handle her rejection. He turned to drugs, to fill the void in a famous headline-catching storyline. Oh my, the girl doesn't want him, so he falls apart.
That's the storyline that Stan pushed to get published, despite the Comics Code refusing to put their stamp on it. And they did publish it. So,
By dumping Harry, MJ inadvertently set into motion events that would change the lives of all the Spider-Man cast for all time. Distraught over his son's drug addiction, Norman Osborn relapsed in his Green Goblin persona and acted upon the knowledge of Peter Parker's secret identity. In the resulting battle, both Gwen and the Goblin were dead, and Peter Parker's world was shattered. MJ showed her first shred of true compassion by staying with the distraught Peter and helping him through his grief. Incoming Spider-Man writer Jerry Conway preferred MJ to Gwen, who he considered boring. By clearing the field of Gwen, MJ and Peter had a chance. They continued to date for several years, and Peter eventually proposed to her. Fearing commitment, MJ ran and actually left the book for several years. When she returned, writer Tom DeFalco decided to show a different side to Mary Jane. She revealed she had known Peter's secret from the start and had pulled away from him due to worry over his safety and the inability to accept his dangerous lifestyle. The two became closer, and it wasn't long until Peter popped the question rather quickly and unexpectedly. Even more unexpected was MJ's answer of yes. The two were wed in Amazing Spider-Man Annual No. 21 and in other media at the same time. Their nuptials are one of the first examples of media corporate synergy that every entertainment company gabs about. The reason for the quick wedding in the comics was their storyline naturally progressing to that stage in the Spider-Man comic strip, which Stan Lee was still helming. Marvel Comics editor-in-chief Jim Shooter sent word down that the two were to be married to tie into the strip, and a real-life version was staged with actors in Yankee Stadium. Marriage is a great change in anyone's life, as Chris and I can both attest to, but for luckless Peter Parker to be married to a gorgeous supermodel was a shift of seismic proportions. Even though MJ knew of the dangers involved in marrying Spider-Man, she could never guess how close they would hit to home. When their home was invaded by Venom, MJ demanded Peter stop wearing his black costume that was so similar to Venom's symbiote look. So Spidey went back to his classic red and blue, and MJ's modeling career skyrocketed. She soon found herself on the receiving end of unwanted advances from a rich admirer who used his clout to destroy her career when his plot to kidnap her backfired on him. MJ and Peter were soon cut off from their now extravagant lifestyle, and she had to take a job as an actress on a soap opera, playing a character she despised. The early years of their marriage over the course of the late 80s and early 90s seemed to be their only true happy period, as creative team after creative team seemed uncertain with what to do with the couple. Their happiness seemed to fly in the face of the personal doom Peter Parker seemed destined to suffer. Soon the couple was embroiled in the infamous clone saga, which revealed the Peter Parker MJ had married was not the original, but a clone. MJ decided to stand by her man, despite him striking her in a scene that few fans will let go.
Oh no, man, that still just gets constantly brought up, that Peter Parker hit Mary Jane. It's just...
I'm sorry, but what do you think would happen to you if you ever laid a hand on me?
Well, I wouldn't lay a hand on you, but
I know, you would never do that, but...
It's even worse when you've got the proportionate strength of a spider.
Exactly. You know, I'm sorry, but Burning Bed would have nothing on it, I'm telling you. Anyway, MJ decided to stand by her man, despite him striking her. It didn't help that MJ was pregnant at this point. With the other Peter taking the name of Ben Reilly in the guise of Spider-Man, Peter and MJ left New York and the series to live normal lives. But comic fans didn't take to Ben Reilly, and a reversal was soon in order, with Peter revealed to be the real deal all along, and the whole thing having been orchestrated by a return from the grave, Norman Osborn. Peter was forced to return to his crime-fighting role, and MJ's baby was stillborn. From this point on, MJ and Peter bounced between times of separation and reconciliation for some time. The couple reunited in time for Marvel's Civil War event, and where, as we discussed before, heroes were written wildly out of character to move the plot along. Spider-Man reveals his ID to the world, backing Tony Stark's Superhuman Registration Act. This makes MJ and Aunt May a target for his enemies, just as he always said it would. Aunt May is shot and lies on the brink of death for some time. In the still controversial One More Day storyline, MJ brokers a deal with Mephisto to trade her past as Peter's wife for Mary her Aunt May's life and wiping Peter's secret ID from the world's minds. The deal is done, and suddenly Peter and MJ were never married. They just dated for a long time and came close to marrying. These events were set into motion by Marvel editor-in-chief Joe Quesada, who always felt a Spider-Man that was married was unrelatable to young readers, but also felt a divorce was too negative to go through with. What this brought about was a resonating feeling of Peter and Mary Jane forever dancing the dance of will they, won't they get back together. This touchy relationship was further tested by the presence of Dr. Octopus's mind in Peter's body for the past year in Superior Spider-Man, where Ock made increasingly strong advances to an MJ who was put out by Peter's new and less than admirable character traits. MJ didn't follow her future hubby into other media much until the 90s Spider-Man animated series. There she played quite a large part of several storylines. She has appeared in every subsequent Spider-Man animated series as a love interest, or at least a potential one. She became a household name thanks to the Sam Raimi-directed trilogy of Spider-Man films beginning in 2002. Bits of the tangled web of comic continuity were assembled to create the rocky romance of the cinematic Peter and MJ. The funny thing about it, I always thought, was when the Spider-Man were movies out, I collect Barbies, and one of the things that came out of that was it was Mary Jane in her wedding dress, and there was no Spider-Man to be had, even though later they did a Brandon Routh and Lois Lane Superman, which we'll touch on a little bit later, but, you know, Mary Jane was the one to beat for that, and one of the best dolls of that particular line.
Yeah, I think probably because I can't think of his name, but her wedding dress was actually designed by a famous designer.
Yeah, I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Yeah, and I believe he actually passed away before the issue was published, if I remember right. The whole thing with the wedding, at least to me, the marriage of Peter and Mary Jane always seemed like it was a rushed into idea. It's like they didn't think, what is this going to do down the line? It was like, you know, Stan, from what I understand, I didn't read the Spider-Man strip because we didn't get it in any papers around here, but from what I understand, the storyline had naturally progressed in this comic strip to the point where it made sense for them to marry.
Mm-hmm.
But in the comic, it really didn't. Mary Jane had only been back for a while. Peter still had Spider-Man, at least, still had a thing going on with the Black Cat off and on. And it really did seem to come out of nowhere that they got married. And I think the storylines that have resulted in the last, you know, 20, 25 years since then really do show that it really wasn't a natural fit. Now, I don't agree with what they did to fix it. I mean, the whole deal with even going back into the Civil War thing, I can't ever imagine a Peter Parker that would just willingly reveal his identity, because that, especially one that was married, you know, I mean, that was if anybody had ever read any Steve Ditko, Stan Lee, Spider-Man's, he was mortified that his secret would be revealed, more so than any other comic book character.
It was ingrained in his character, and it just went along to further the story, to make the story happen.
Right. I mean, for whatever reason,
To me, anymore, as a comic reader myself, I find that you have comic writers who write a story and then plug characters into it rather than taking their characters and writing a story around those characters. It's backwards to the way that it should be.
Right, right. And, you know, why those guys don't go off and write their own characters, especially when many of them bellyache about, well, I can't do what I want to with these characters and I don't own them. Well, go make Bug Guy and do what you want to with him, you know. But back to the Spider-Man Mary Jane thing, I can understand why creators struggled with it and have struggled with it. It really does. It has always, to me, seemed like something that you know, a handful of people decided on, and now everybody else has had to deal with it since then. And we'll get to Lois and Superman, but you know, in a little bit. But to me, that was it's about time. Thing. You know, it was time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It all had been done before. You know, every other permeation of the relationship had been done. The thing that hadn't been done was get them married. With Spider-Man and Mary Jane, I just don't think they were there. They weren't there as characters. They weren't there. The relationship wasn't there for them. She had been out of the books. I only knew Mary Jane, oddly enough, from a Power record that I had. She was not in the comics when I was reading them through the very early 80s until she showed back up in around what it was 84 or 5. It was after Spider-Man was in the black suit and back right around the time he found out that it was a symbiote and all that stuff. So it just did not seem like a good fit. And you know, I mean, it's not that they're not a good, it couldn't be a good couple, but the marriage thing if they'd had them date and got closer and like they got married like 2 or 3 years later, I think it probably would have worked out better. But they needed a more solid foundation,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it's unfortunate, you know, that they've done this the deal with Mephisto thing. How that's better than a divorce, I don't know. It's better to make a deal with Satan than get a divorce, you know.
Yeah.
People can relate more to people, you know, making deals with Satan than. Because people don't get divorced. That doesn't happen.
Oh, heavens no.
That doesn't happen in real life. People can't relate to that. But, you know, and what I find funny is that they keep, even though they've split them up and they're like they never got married, they're still, the reader knows they were married and it's still in the book that, okay, we know you know they were married.
Right.
So, you know, other than, let's just drop it and never mention it again, which is what, if they're going to do it, just do it. Just don't mention it again. Just drop it. But they just keep, you know, I guess maybe that's for the people that are still hoping they'll get back together, which they might someday. But and maybe if they do, maybe they'll people take the time to naturally let their relationship progress. So I will say on the subject of Mary Jane that that her character became increasingly unlikable in the Spider-Man film series. By the final movie, which has a lot of problems anyway, I just really didn't care what happened to her. I mean, and I think, and Kirsten Dunst, she was fine in the first movie, but she seemed half asleep in a good chunk of two and all of three.
Oh, she didn't want to be there. You could tell she didn't want to be there, but she had probably signed a contract to do a 3-movie deal, and she was going through the paces. It also didn't help that, and here's some celebrity scuttlebutt, that she and Tobey Maguire were actually a couple in the first one, and they had broken up. So, you know, here, I used to, you know, kiss and hug and love on you and everything else off the scenes, but now I still got to act like I like you, even though you're a jackass.
So. Right, right, yeah. So that could have been a good chunk of it, too. But, yeah, she just, you know, by the time that... It seems like we're really bashing on the Mary Jane character, and I actually like the character. I mean, I always thought MJ was a fun character. And I liked when they gave her some substance, you know, when she came back in the 80s. And that was one of the few retcons that actually worked, that, you know, I've known your secret all along. And if you read, it doesn't really work if you read the books. Because there's things that she does when Peter ducks out to be Spider-Man, where she'll call attention to him being a worm for running out and make him look bad. If she really knew, she'd be covering
Helping
for him.
Cover him up.
Yeah.
I don't know. I personally always thought that Gwen Stacy was a better fit than Mary Jane was. Because it's just the old storyline of, you know, nerd falls in love with hot chick and then therefore is forever grateful because she's a hot chick and do whatever you want.
See any episode of The Big Bang Theory. but
I know, but I'm saying...
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's Leonard and Penny on The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, he's in love with the hot chick, and, you know, he'll do anything to keep her, even though, other than being hot, she really ain't got much going for her.
Well, what I'm saying is Gwen Stacy is a better fit. They have a similar interest. They, you know, everything goes along better, and to me, it just flows better. And, I mean, it's one of those things that I wonder... Like you said, if she had been drawn by
Ditko,
then would that have progressed more that way? You know, because you have the whole hot chick aspect.
Right, right. Well, Ditko actually did draw Gwen, but it didn't take long for Romita to kind of tweak her design and make her, you know, a lot more attractive, because he just drew more attractive women. But Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, who knows if they hadn't killed Gwen. I mean, Gwen was basically killed off because Jerry Conway didn't like her. He was the, you know, and then Jerry Conway, I love almost everything he wrote, and it's a great story. And it certainly set up a lot of great, you know, storylines and angst for Spider-Man, which, you know, that's the story of Spider-Man is angst. He's the original angst guy, you know.
Yeah, true.
So, but, I mean, you know, it's just, it'd be interesting to see if a different writer was on it, they probably would never have killed her and where they would have been. And, you know, and then you've got, and I can't help but bring this up, this is a good chance, but you got people, you know, J. Michael Straczynski created Babylon 5. You know, sure, he's a fantastic writer. I've read stuff he's written. It's great. But the fact that they let that guy go back and write that storyline set in the past where Gwen and Norman Osborn had an affair.
Oh, heavens. You were telling me about that. I haven't read it
myself. That's a case of comic editors not saying, you know what? No, I don't care who you are. You can't do that.
Right.
You know, the stewardship of the characters that was such a big thing back in the, through the golden age up until to the 80s, it's gone, you know.
Well, I mean, it just goes back to the point that I was making earlier in that, you know, like I said, you have a lot of writers that are having a story and then fitting these characters into that story regardless of past character development and everything else. Instead of having the characters and writing a story around them, they're having a story and then shoving the characters into that story.
You know, I dabble in writing, and I'm not saying I'm J. Michael Straczynski. I'm not, but I always thought one of the things you always you're supposed to ask yourself as a writer is, especially with an established character, would this character do that?
Yeah, is this true to form?
Would this character say this? There was never anything established that Gwen Stacy would screw around on Peter Parker with anyone, let alone Norman Osborn. If you read the comics, there's absolutely nothing going on between them other than he is Harry's dad.
Yeah.
That's a very tangential relationship. He kills her or, you know, I mean, sets about her death, whatever killed her, the fall, the snap of the neck when the webs caught her, whatever. But yeah, that's just, that story was just ridiculous. I don't know how we got so much on. That's another thing. You can't talk about Peter and Mary Jane's relationship without talking about Gwen.
No.
And so I think that's another thing. They made Gwen, and over time, made her such a specter over their relationship.
True.
You know, it there's always going to be that it should have been Gwen.
Well, you almost wonder, you see so many times, and I mean, this is just in real life, but you see people are like, okay, this person, there's a couple that they were married forever, you know, 20, 30 years, and then something happens, and then the guy just picks up, and this happens more with men than women, and I'm sorry to say, but it's true. Men, generally, if their spouse passes away, they get remarried within 2 years. Because they're like, okay, you're available, fine, I can't be alone.
Right.
And so he went with the available hot chick, you know, that was with him.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, they did show, and I mean, in the first story after the resolution of Gwen's death, you know, Peter, you know, comes into his apartment, Mary Jane's there, and she's like, oh, I heard about Gwen, I'm so sorry, and I can't believe it. And he's like, well, what do you care? You know, you don't care about anybody. You wouldn't even care if your own mother was dead, which is kind of bad because later they reveal that her mother was dead. And Mary Jane starts to leave, but Peter's just, it's silent. He's just sitting there sobbing, and she shuts the door. That's the first shred of true character that I think Mary Jane
had.
Well,
and that also might be, you know, the whole Florence Nightingale syndrome, you know. A lot of women like to take care of the old sad sack, or, you know, because they're hurting or whatever, and, you know, they stay with them, kind of like the whole Marty McFly.
Yeah. Yeah, and his mom.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, let's. I think we've taken this to beyond it's in its unnatural conclusion now. And now we save the best for last, Superman and Lois Lane. They are the first couple of comics. Don't give me any contenders, because there are none. Created, of course, by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, Superman and Lois Lane debuted together in Action Comics number 1, June 1938. And, of course, everyone listening to this probably knew that. He was the champion of the oppressed, disguised as a mild-mannered reporter and she was his intrepid co-worker, every bit his equal as a reporter, and no less brave than his super-powered persona. There was an attraction from the first panel they met, after Lois got over the initial shock of a super-powered man in a circus outfit, but she wouldn't give Clark the time of day, and thus the nearly eternal love triangle was formed. The classic formula that would continue on for decades was nearly cut short just a few years into the Superman legend. Siegel and Shuster actually produced a story where Superman first encounters K-Metal, an early forerunner of the yet-to-be-introduced Kryptonite, and Lois learns his secret. She would have been his aide and confidant in keeping his identity hidden after that. But DC higher-ups nixed the idea, knowing better than to mess with such a good thing. Over the course of the 1940s, Superman slowly evolved from social defender to upholder of American ideals, thanks to the increased patriotism during and after World War II. Lois also changed, going from an independent go-getter to husband-chasing madwoman at times. During the war, women had briefly assumed the roles of men who were off to serve, but after the conflict was over, they settled down with the returning men, and many became housewives. It would seem Lois was after the same thing, but Superman wouldn't stand still long enough for her to catch him. Thus began innumerable stories where Lois tried to expose Superman's secret. She long suspected Clark may be Superman, but he was constantly misdirecting her, often making her doubt her own senses. The Superman stories of the mid-50s through the 60s seemed geared toward a younger audience than many of their contemporaries. And Mort Weisinger, who was the editor, often considered himself an expert in giving kids what they wanted. He often claimed he polled kids on what they'd like to see in the books. The somewhat daft portrayal of Lois makes sense if you take into account the fact young boys stereotypically think girls are icky and will do anything to stay away from their romantic advances.
Aww.
One can look at the Silver Age Lois as that annoying girl on the playground who is constantly after a boy who has no interest in her or any other girl. Sure, there were still stories that played lip service to the romance. Most of these were imaginary tales that did not affect the continuity of the ongoing books, where Superman and Lois could marry. Lois had her ups and downs during the Silver Age, gaining her own title, Superman's girlfriend, Lois Lane, full of Superman entrapment tales, but also gaining a new rival in Lana Lang, who came over from the Superboy stories all grown up and ready to vie for Clark and Superman's affections. And one of the most famous imaginary tales during the Weisinger era, Superman got to marry both his gals in the amazing story of Superman Red and Superman Blue. By the late 60s, comic readers had matured, and the women's lib movement was in full swing, so the Superman-Lois dynamic was in need of an overhaul. On the cover of her 80th issue, Lois is seen ripping the girlfriend from her logo and telling Superman to get out of her title. Of course, this was a lot of hyperbole that didn't really go anywhere, but clearly the days of loopy marriage plots was nearing its end. During this period, Lois traded her classic pillbox hat for some rather skimpy mod fashions. Mm-hmm. The Superman title got a much-needed shot in the arm when the retiring Weisinger gave way to Julia Schwartz, who had revamped nearly everyone else at DC by this point. Schwartz brought a more contemporary feel to his stories, and Lois took more notice of Clark. In the storyline where Superman seemingly lost his powers for good, it's heavily hinted at that Lois and Clark spent the night together. In Action Comics number 484, the 40th anniversary issue, Lois finally got her Superman, and the Man of Steel is shown carrying both his wedding gown attired bride and a car through the sky. The editor Schwartz was playing a fast one on us. This isn't the contemporary Superman and Lois of Earth 1, but their Earth 2 counterparts. In a story set on the world where the Golden Age stories are canon, with a few alterations to spice things up, Lois and Clark marry in 1952 when Clark is temporarily robbed of his powers and any memory he has of the Man of Steel. Lois eventually deduces her long-held suspicions were correct and helps bring the Man of Tomorrow back. Superman finally realizes what he'd been missing, and the two renew their vows, this time in a Kryptonian ceremony. Back on Earth 1, the romance was cranked up in the Superman titles in the late 70s due to the influence of Superman the movie and the significance of the Superman-Lois relationship in that film. Superman and Lois were actually a couple for quite a while through the early 80s. Of course, drama must ensue, and they broke up seemingly forever. Clark rebounded quickly by beginning a long burgeoning relationship with Lana Lang. In DC Comics Presents Annual Number 1, the Earth 2 Superman extols the virtues of wedded bliss to his younger counterpart. Meanwhile, the Lois Lane of Earth 3, where heroes are villains and villains are heroes, falls in love with none other than that Earth's Luthor. It seems everyone gets their Lois, but the standard Superman. This story is somewhat of a prequel to Crisis on Infinite Earths, the maxi series that merged all of DC's multiple Earths into one, in the hopes that the streamlined history would be easier to digest. In that regard, it failed, but it's a hell of a story. The story begins with the Earth 3 Alexander Luthor and Lois launching their son to safety as their world dies. Near the title's end...
Now Kryptonian-like.
Yeah. It's like, I've seen that before. Near the title's end, the Earth 2 Superman is left alone. His wife Lois seemingly made non-existent in the merging of worlds. With nothing left to lose, it is he who deals the final blow that destroys the villain of the piece, the Anti-Monitor. The war-weary Man of Steel is given his final reward by a powerful Alexander Luthor Jr. and is reunited with Lois to live in eternal peace, never to return again. If only. Writer-artist John Byrne was tapped to relaunch the Man of Steel into a new post-crisis continuity, and of course Lois was along for the ride. A civilian Clark Kent saves an experimental space plane Lois was on, and she dubs him Superman. He takes the name to heart, and he and Paul Kent develop his S-Shield after the name she gave him. Byrne's Superman seemed more smitten with this Lois, and certainly more amiable to flirtation than his often stoic Earth-1 counterpart. Lois does not take a liking to Clark Kent, however, as the newest member of the Daily Planet staff scoops her on the details of the Caped Wonder.
Oh, how hard is it when he's writing about himself?
That's kind of dirty.
But it is.
But it got him a job, and he needed to be where he could get a hold of the news.
However, if he's upholding the ideas of truth and honor and blah, 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 he just did a whammy.
Well, he paid for it. Byrne carried this animosity forward throughout his nearly 2 years on the title, with Lois often coming across as rather unlikable, and that's putting it lightly. Think of the word that sounds like witch but starts with a B. It was hard to see what Superman saw in her outside of tradition. Lois was a bit kinder over in Adventures of Superman by writer Marv Wolfman and artist Jerry Ordway. There she met and dated Jose Delgado, who was also the vigilante known as Gangbuster. Meanwhile, Superman was pining for Wonder Woman, who in the new post-crisis continuity he had just recently met. Byrne had the two heroes hook up briefly in Action Comics number 600, but they parted as just friends by issue's end. After Byrne left abruptly, the Superman creative team seemed to make it their mission to make Lois a likable character once more. Fans noticed, and so did Clark Kent. He lost his powers in the Crisis of the Crimson Kryptonite storyline, and figuring he would never be able to be Superman again, proposed to Lois. Unsurprisingly, he regained his powers, but shockingly, Lois said yes in Superman number 50. There was still one problem. She still didn't know his secret. Superman struggled with this issue only for a brief while, determining his soon-to-be wife had a right to know who she was marrying. Thus, in Action Comics number 667, the secret was revealed, and the Superman mythos were never the same. After the initial shock wore off, Lois became a great companion and confidant for Clark. Their engagement was intended to be a relatively short one, but Hollywood thought otherwise. Remember that corporate synergy stuff from the Spidey MJ portion? Well, it changed the wedding into a funeral. WB was developing a Lois and Clark TV series and hoped to marry them at some point down the line. Some higher-ups felt the comic wedding should coincide with the TV event, should it ever happen, so wedding plans were postponed. Instead, the super creators chose to kill their hero and see what happened to his cast without him. Lois was at his side when he succumbed to the fatal wound sustained in stopping the monstrous doomsday. Of course, he did get better.
It's comics.
And Lois was waiting for him upon his return from beyond. Like nearly every couple, they encountered some bumps in the road of love and split up, with Lois taking a job as a foreign correspondent briefly. The time had come for the TV Lois and Clark to wed, so the comic couple had to have a very rushed reconciliation to make it to the church on time for Superman the Wedding Special in 1996. So at last, Lois and Clark were married. Not a hoax, not an imaginary story, and not a parallel Earth. The current versions of the two tied the knot. For the next 15 years, through many creators, massive crossovers, changes in powers and costumes, they stuck it out, with only a few minor hiccups in the road. Lois was normally portrayed as an able companion, capable of holding her own, and seldom needing a rescue like in the days of old.
She kicked butt all on her own.
That's right. Some creators publicly lamented that they couldn't turn back the clock and undo the marriage, but it seemed that this change was permanent, and the new status quo. Well, it was, for quite a while. But after soft rebooting Superman and keeping the marriage a few times, they finally caved in and rebooted the whole DCU in the New 52 relaunch. In the first months of the new initiative, DC shot a blast across the bow that the new Lois and Clark were back at square one. At the end of Superman number 1, volume 3, Clark visits Lois at her apartment to find her shirtless boyfriend. The honeymoon was over, and in fact, it had now never begun. These days, Superman can be seen sucking face with Wonder Woman in their own Superman-Wonder Woman title. Whether or not this new version of Lois and Superman will ever fulfill their ultimate destiny remains to be seen. Lois has followed Superman into every medium he has conquered, appearing in nearly every iteration of the legend. One can argue she got more screen time in the 40s theatrical shorts by the Fleischer and Famous studios. Her presence on the 1950s Adventures of Superman TV series led to her getting her own title. In Superman II, the couple were shown to have consummated their relationship. And in the latter-day follow-up Superman Returns, that consummation resulted in a super son, much to the chagrin of nearly everyone but Bryan Singer. Of course, there was Lois and Clark, where she became the true star of the show and made actress Terry Hatcher the pioneer of internet photo downloads. In the recent Man of Steel movie, Amy Adams' Lois is in on the secret from the start and even helps Clark concoct his mild-mannered persona.
I honestly like Erica Durance's portrayal on Smallville because she, you know, after she figured it out, she helped. She, you know, I liked her portrayal, either her or Phyllis Coates, the first portrayal or the last. Well, man, you know, aside from Amy Adams, but I'm talking about, you know, small screen.
Yeah, I liked Erica Durance.
I know you did.
For obvious reasons, but I also like the way she played her. I mean, you just couldn't not like her. I mean, she, you know, she was spunky, you know, but she, the one thing about Terry Hatcher's Lois, I mean, you liked her, but she was really self-centered. I mean, like,
oh, yeah.
Really. And, you know, you kind of, other than the fact that she was very attractive, you kind of wondered, you know, what Superman saw in her, you know.
Come on now. I mean, you're talking about Terry Hatcher. Let's talk about Margot Kidder if you're talking about what did Superman see her. I'm sorry, but excuse me, this might be a non-G-rated comment, but damn! God!
Well, now, I will say that Margot Kidder in the first film was fairly attractive. Now, she's not, like, ultra attractive. I will go there. You know, Christopher Reeve, obviously very handsome man.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Obviously very handsome man. Margot Kidder, not equally attractive in the female department.
No.
By the time Superman 2, most of Superman 2, that the theatrical film, the theatrical version, the Lester version, was shot, I think Margot Kidder's lifestyle was catching up to her, and she looked very haggard.
Rode hard, put up wet?
She did not look... if you sit down and watch Superman 2, the Lester cut, where there's obviously scenes that Donner shot and scenes Lester shot, it's kind of funny to see...
You can see the difference. You can almost say, okay, from this scene to this scene, this was shot 3-4 years ago, and this scene to this scene, this is current.
It's kind of funny because Christopher Reeve, and a lot of, especially the scenes involving Hackman, they had to shoot those early because they only had a window of time with Hackman.
Because he was shooting the French Connection?
No, he'd already done that. It was something else. But he was, you know, they only had him for so long. So, you know, Reeve was still working out. He wasn't bulked up like he was in later parts. So even in Superman 2, like where they're in the fortress talking about the molecule chamber and all that stuff, He's Christopher Reeve's kind of gaunt looking. I mean, compared, not gaunt, but he's thinner looking than he is in other scenes in Superman the movie, and especially Superman 2, the Lester shot.
I feel like he had like you know, some kind of pump in his suit going ch-ch-ch-ch-ch.
No, it was all him.
I know.
If you, you know, a casual viewer is not going to notice that, but it's kind of weird because, you know.
Yeah, but somebody like you that's seen it 485 times is going to notice that.
Well, and then when you learn the history, you're just amazed that that Superman 2 ever even came out. Because of the problems and just the firing of the of Donner and Lester, and of course Margot Kidder was not happy with what they did. She was the most vocal,
mm-hmm.
And which is why she only is in Superman 3 for about 5 minutes.
You honestly, I mean, for that you have to respect.
I do respect her
for that.
I do. I know people like to pick on Margot Kidder. She's had a lot of problems. And you know, but you got to respect her that she, you know, she apparently stood up for him more than about anybody else, in, except for Hackman, who wouldn't return. Hackman right. would not come back. He would everything. If you hear, it's somebody. It's usually a body double and some guy doing a Hackman impression of the voice. You never see him from the front in a lot of scenes. You know, he's flying on the back of Nahn and he drops him in the snow in the fortress and stuff like that. But, yeah, you know, as far as the older Lois, is you had Noelle Neal, who was the first screen Lois in the serials, and then Phyllis Coates was the Lois in the first season of The Adventures of Superman, and then she wasn't available because there was a big gap between when they filmed season one and when the show aired.
Right.
And then it got picked up for season two. And she wasn't available, so they called back Noelle Neal. And their portrayals of Lois are like night and day.
Mm-hmm.
Because Phyllis Coates plays a very hard-nosed... She's like the original Lois of the comics. She's more the hard-nosed reporter.
Very capable.
Very capable. But man, she's really attractive. She's very pretty. And not that Noelle Neal's not, but she's pretty more in like a girl-next-door type
way. Right.
And Phyllis Coates is more pretty in like a Hollywood starlet of the 40s type way. And but man, she could be kind of witchy too sometimes, you know.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But you
she's
know,
what you'd call a ball buster.
She was a ball buster. But she those early, you know, film noir type Adventures of Superman episodes are really cool to watch. Although I can't help it. I like the goofy color episodes with Noelle Neal and you know, with Jack Larson get to do goofy things. And
well, that's true.
It's
They're
just
sweet.
Fun, and you know, and George, he just gets to break through a wall and look like he's having fun doing it, because apparently he did. So I really enjoy watching those old shows. And we had a cool encounter with Noelle Neal.
Oh, that was so sweet.
You know, Noelle Neal, for years, she always would come to the Metropolis, Illinois Superman celebration. And she was supposed to be there that year, but we went. It was... Our son, he's 12 now. He was like, what, maybe two?
Maybe two.
He was walking.
2.5.
He was walking, but we were in the Superman Museum on the Friday that the celebration was beginning, and I saw Noelle Neal, and I remember I told you, I'm like, that's Noelle Neal, but I didn't want to say anything to her. I didn't want to bother her, because I think she just got into town, and
somebody was taking her through the museum.
Yeah, and I didn't want to bother her. And
she's a really beautiful older lady.
Oh, yeah, yeah, she really is.
She is.
I mean, you can just see that spark in her eyes that she's still the same,
mm-hmm.
as, you know, the TV show, and it makes you instantly know that's Lois Lane, you know. And, well, you tell the part.
Andrew, you got to think, our kid... You know, being 2.5, he was adorable and everything else. And we were walking through, and she actually stopped and stooped down, and she said, well, hello, little one. And Andrew waved at her, but, you know, he had no idea. You know, he's 2.5. And I told him later, I said, do you know who that was? No.
Yes.
And, you know, I said, you know, and I told him, I said, that was Lois Lane. I said, that was, you know, the lady that played Superman's girlfriend on the old shows that you and Daddy watch. He's like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. And to me, that was better than having her autographed. We always
have
that story to tell. So, you know, it was better than waiting in line or anything. I still should have got her autograph. But you know, when you got a 2-year-old, it's not...
Not exactly feasible in June heat.
Yeah. So but yeah, that was our cute little Lois Lane story. So, next time we have an all-new theme. We'll be covering 2 episodes of Batman the Animated Series.
And it's going to feature our 2 favorite episodes.
Right. Robin's Reckoning Part 1 and Legends of the Dark Knight. So you get an episode from each version of Batman the Animated Series.
And let's face it, to me, Bruce Timm, they should just give him the DC Universe, and there you go.
Yep, that's we're pretty much in agreement on that. So join us for that, and we appreciate you listening. If you've got any comments you'd like to make on this episode, drop us a line at the blog or email us at supermatespodcast@gmail.com. Take care, and we'll see you soon. See ya. Bye.
What this brought about was a resonating feeling of Peter and Mary Jane forever dancing the dance of will they, won't they get back together. This touchy relationship was further tested by the presence of Dr. Octopus's mind in Peter's body for the past year.